Today? This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. It is May the 22nd, and we are here today to hear from our university friends and then some discussion of ballot measure 99. So, Doug?
Mr. Chair, if you remember right, when we went through the public university programs as part of HEC's budget, there were folks wanting a little more detail on the various state programs. There won't be a presentation from a person representing each, as I understand, but there are folks in the audience that can answer specific questions on them. What we would like to do is divide up about half the meeting, roughly half the meeting for the state programs, and then leave the second remaining half or the remainder of the time to discuss the outdoor school ballot measure 99, which is also a budget question for you. There's roughly $44 million in a modified current service level since this was a ballot measure that passed. It's factored into the co-chair's framework at $24 million at this point instead of the full $44 million. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would call up the public university various representatives.
Okay. Jan Lewis, Jack Barth, and Sheila Martin.
Super, thanks.
Do we have a, Michael, is there a presentation we can put up, or I bet they didn't?
Is that this?
Yes, there is a presentation on today's OAS.
Technology, it's so wonderful.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks.
Good morning.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith Warner and members of the committee. My name is Jan Lewis. I'm the Interim Associate Vice President for Finance and Administration at Oregon State University. And we have several folks here to talk to you today about some of the state programs. And so I thank you for that opportunity. Some of you may remember prior to the governance change that the public universities used to get their primary operating support in the form of an appropriation known as Education in General, or E&G. And that was primarily allocated based on enrollment, but there were a number of line item allocations known as targeted programs. Mm-hmm. And in 2013, when the legislature divided the E&G funding into two new buckets, the Public University Support Fund and the state programs, the Legislative Fiscal Office went through those targeted programs, looking for those with legislative origin and those that predominantly serve broader state purposes like economic development and natural resources. And those were then moved over into that state program umbrella. So in April, you heard from the Tallwood Design Institute and the Oregon Renewable Energy Center.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. What was the decision in making it changing the two pots?
Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith Warner and Representative Wisnett, I don't know the actual underlying reason. Preceded by a lot of changes in how the budget was looked at. We went through some funding teams, and so there may have been some desire to pull those out because they had legislative interest over time and to perhaps elevate those so you could more easily look at those and recognize them in terms of when budgets were allocated.
Quick follow-up. So it was a university decision, not the legislative decision?
No, it actually came out of the legislature through the Legislative Fiscal Office.
Follow-up.
Go ahead.
But it was a policy decision by LFO, not by the legislature.
Mr. Chair, it was a legislative decision. And I think it was proposed. It was during the time that the public university system was changing its governance models, you know, roughly in that same time period. And these programs had already always been funded and separated in by OUS. Yeah. And at that time, when OUS went away, you had the division.
Thank you.
And
Senator Roseman.
And if you look at them, I think they're the three that are kind of the big ones that have been there for a long time, Extension Service, Forest Research, all of those, they seem to be, most of them come out of Oregon State, but and I think part of their land grant formation. The other ones have been developed over time to meet individual needs and basically taken on by individual universities more based on the kinds of expertise they have. And I think that's why, for a long time, to me, that was the reason that the conversation happened and the separation. There's one group of them that have been here. We anticipate they'll be here forever. There's another group that have come on to the scene, fermentation being one of the last ones, science. And so looking at them in a different way makes some sense, I think, and I think that's what happened. Because if you look at the different ones in this category as opposed to the ones the page before, there's that significant difference.
Okay.
And just along those same lines, Senator Roblin, the statewide public services that you mentioned, Experiment Station and Extension and the Forest Research Laboratory, those have had their line item appropriations for quite a long time.
Right.
And so this is sort of a quasi-group in that it's the umbrella of state programs and then all those individual ones that were pulled over.
Yeah.
So today we're going to hear in detail from the Population Research Center at Portland State University and the Marine Research Vessel at Oregon State University, but we'll briefly touch on the individual ones and try to give you enough time to hear more from those two groups. So I'll start with the engineering sustaining funds.
Representative Wisnett.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair. Are we going to hear, I have some policy issues. Are we going to hear about those? Are you going to be able to address those? You're going to give us presentations about the individual centers now, right?
Right, although very briefly, since we have the two groups here to talk in more detail.
Okay, but who can talk about policy as far as, are these people on PERS, are these people on a state health plan?
Yes, we will mention that because each
in your presentation or during theirs?
Well, I basically can just tell you that all of these programs are fully integrated into the universities. So when you're talking about employees of these programs, they're university employees, university benefits, they follow university policies, and they all work together with the other university activities in terms of furthering the missions, you know, of our instruction, research, and public service.
Follow up, Mr.
Coach. Go ahead.
Thank you for that information. So when they're formed, that the legislature made the decision they're automatically part of PERS and the health care program?
That may have been intentional, or it may have just been by default because of the fact that the universities were hosting these different organizations. They, in essence, became part of the university.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair. Does the state provide their office, their computers, their travel expense? How do they get all their equipment? Is that part of what's we're funding?
So I'm going to make a general statement, and I, you know, there could be some slight variations that I'm not aware of, but for the most part, these are actually hosted at the universities in our facilities, and you might just as easily go to some other research institute at a university and look at them in the same way. I think what distinguishes them here is that they do have sort of some legislative origin connection and interest in a dedicated funding stream.
Go ahead.
Could you provide this committee the legislative authorization or establishment of all the programs, please?
We can, and I think perhaps at our presentation in April, there was a supplemental packet, and I believe the legislative origins were quoted in each of those as far as the Senate bills or House bills in the year.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. What is the Labor Education Research Center authorization?
That I know it's from 1977, so it's an older one, and I don't know if I have that on hand, but
it's
we can
not
get
enough.
That for
they
you.
Have no authorization for it. There's a budget item.
I don't think so.
Well,
I think there's some legislation.
No,
okay, we'll look.
So well, that's the best you can give us then.
I can check with others in the audience if you need a specific reference on that, or we can have them.
Doug's going to pull up what they presented.
It's in the budget, I have it in my office, 1978, $300 and some thousand dollars.
Okay. Moving right along.
So for the engineering sustaining funds, this is a funding source that's undergone a bit of migration over the years. It originated as funding distributed through the Engineering and Technology Industry Council, or ETIC. In 2014, it was briefly transferred to the Oregon Education Investment Board. Then the funding was split. Some went to the Oregon Talent Council to award the funding through a grant process, but most of it went to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to become the engineering sustaining funds. And one of the original goals of this funding was to improve and expand engineering facilities, programs, and educational capacity to meet the engineering and technology needs of Oregon's private and public sectors. The original target was to double the number of degrees, and that has been exceeded. All of the public universities participate in this funding, but I'll just speak from the OSU perspective. We get about $7 million annually, and we've had significant gains as a result of the 15 years of this funding. OSU's College of Engineering is the 11th largest college of engineering in the United States. Research expenditures have tripled. Faculties have grown from 100 to 182, students from 2,800 to 8,700, and more importantly, the number of graduates increased from 300 to 1,358. As you heard in April, the Tallwood Design Institute is the new name for Advanced Wood Products. They do industry-focused applied research, product development and testing, as well as training and education with the goal of growing the mass timber manufacturing base in Oregon. Dispute resolution funding supports the Oregon Consensus Program at Portland State University, where since 2005 it has facilitated over 300 projects to address priorities of the legislature, governor, and state agencies. It also funds the Office for Community Dispute Resolution at the University of Oregon School of Law, where it administers state funds to community programs in 25 Oregon counties. Approximately 900 volunteer mediators respond to community conflicts each year. Since 2002, Oregon Solutions has helped communities implement over 75 projects addressing education, the economy, natural resources, health care, transportation, and energy. For fermentation science, I'd like to quote you a few statistics related to this. Over the last decade, employment has increased 437% in Oregon breweries, 59% in wineries, and 254% in distilleries. Oregon's craft brewing industry contributed $4.5 billion to the state's economy last year, while Oregon's wine industry contributed an additional $3.35 billion. The state's fermentation sciences investment has enabled OSU to hire faculty and staff in distillation, brewing, cheese production, viticulture, and value-added product marketing to support these rapidly expanding industries. It has also allowed us to provide hands-on training and more than double the number of graduates with degrees in viticulture and enology or fermentation sciences. In 2003, the legislature allocated $1 million to support a signature research initiative, and this research focuses on integrating nanotechnology and microtechnology and product engineering and design. I'd like to just expand a little bit on the reference here to the $70 million grant awarded to ATAMI, and that is the Advanced Technology and Manufacturing Institute at Oregon State. A critical element in winning that award was the 15 years of funding support from the state. The Labor Education Research Center was founded in 1977, and it was promoted by an alliance of unions, legislators, university faculty, labor relations professionals, and community leaders who believed that workers and unions in Oregon needed a specific program granting them access to the resources and expertise of the state's higher education system. Now I'd like to turn it over to Sheila Martin from Portland State University, and she's going to talk in detail about the Population Research Center.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner and members of the committee. My name is Sheila Martin. I'm director of the Population Research Center at Portland State University. The Population Research Center has provided service to the state of Oregon since 1956 with the creation of the Oregon Population Estimates Program. In 1965, the program was moved by the legislature to PSU, and today it provides population data, assistance, research, and analysis for communities throughout Oregon. The PRC also provides an important connection between the U.S. Census Bureau and the state of Oregon. We operate four programs that assist communities across the state: the Oregon State Data Center, the Oregon Population Forecast Program, the Oregon Population Estimates Program, and Special Demographic Projects. The Census State Data Center provides training information about census data to many users. Each year, we provide a data users conference that in the past year drew 160 attendees to learn about new data available from the Census Bureau and new tools for downloading, analyzing, and visualizing census data. We also respond to many requests for information and assistance related to census data products. Last year, we responded to over 500 requests from communities all over the state. We also provide presentations and training that reach between 500 and 1,000 additional people every year. Some of the most frequent users of these data and of our services are state and local agencies who are trying to execute their duties and inform their decisions with the best information possible. Most recently, we provided assistance to an employee in Florence who was trying to develop a housing needs assessment and needed to access census data from the American Community Survey, but was having a very difficult time accessing the data and understanding the tools from the Census Bureau. So the geospatial office sent her our way, and we were able to help her, and now she has the information she needs to do this analysis. We also routinely compile census data products into easy-to-use community profiles, which means that a lot of people who we're not even aware of are served without even calling or emailing us. They just download these community profiles, and that gives them the information they need to inform their decision-making. The Oregon Population Forecast Program was started in 2013 to provide methodologically consistent city-county coordinated forecasts that are needed as a starting point for planning decisions around the state. We provide 50-year forecasts for counties and the urban growth boundaries within them at five-year increments and by five-year age groups. I've given each of you a copy of one of the reports from your district or near your district. These data are important not only for land use planning processes, but also for planning other critical infrastructure and economic development projects. We use public input and we gather public input from around the state to ground truth the assumptions that we're making about these population forecasts. We look at economic and other factors that particularly might affect migration of people into and out of these cities and counties. The Oregon Population Estimates Program publishes estimates of population for cities and counties that are used for distributing state funds and for a variety of other planning purposes. The Oregon Population Report reports every year population by five-year age groups and by sex. And finally, because we have really excellent access to data from the Census Bureau and because we're experts in demographic methods, we often engage in special commissioned projects throughout the state. We work for a variety of local government entities and nonprofits to conduct, for example, estimates of populations for special districts, redistricting projects, forecasts for school enrollment, which are necessary for planning school facilities. We do community needs assessments for nonprofits and lots of other kinds of demographic analysis. So now I'll move on to some of the other programs that are covered in this statewide programs. The Institute of Natural Resources is headquartered at Oregon State, but it has staff located at both OSU and PSU. Its mission is to provide access to integrated knowledge and information to inform natural resource decisions and to develop solutions in the context of sustainability. Its focus areas are information access, science synthesis, biodiversity and conservation, landscape assessments, and water issues. The clinical legal education program funding was begun as dedicated court fees, but became a targeted program within the Oregon University system and is now one of the state programs that we're discussing today. The allocation of this funding is application based, and historically it was awarded to legal clinics at both the University of Oregon and Lewis and Clark College. However, Lewis and Clark College recently became ineligible due to changes in its legal clinic services, and since then the University of Oregon Domestic Violence Clinic has been the only recipient. The Oregon Climate Change Research Institute was founded in 2009, and it has leveraged roughly $150,000 a year in state support to win over $42 million in research awards. It hosts two federally funded research enterprises, the Northwest Climate Science Center for the U.S. Department of the Interior and the Climate Impacts Research Consortium for NOAA. The OCCRI has led both region-wide and local efforts to develop and apply science to improve resilience to climate variations, drought, and climate change. It works with faculty, students, and staff at multiple universities and works extensively with state agencies, including the Water Resources Division, the Oregon Health Authority, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and the Department of Forestry. It has co-founded and led an annual conference for the Northwest region in which 300 to 500 scientists, planners, and natural resource managers track the latest developments in decision-relevant regional science. The OCCRI hosts the Oregon Climate Service, which is the official state climate office for Oregon. Portland State University's Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute provides an objective third-party lens to assist the law enforcement contacts, policy, and data review committee in meeting its mission to address biased policing in Oregon. In addition, it provides research expertise to examine disparity in law enforcement outcomes and public impacts and explore best practices. The Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute provides a neutral alternative to the public, a place to turn to lodge a complaint when they believe they may have been targeted by unfair police practices. As you heard in April, the Oregon Renewable Energy Center was authorized in statute in 2001. It hasn't and does not currently receive state-dedicated funding, but the seven university presidents agreed in their consolidated request to seek $985,000 for the Oregon Renewable Energy Center. So I'd like to call the next set of speakers to talk about the marine research vessel at Oregon State, unless there are questions.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I just clarify? It's actually 985,000, not 985 million.
985 okay. million.
Seems like a much more.
It's thousand.
It is thousand. Thousand. Okay, great.
It's almost a million.
Thousand. 985 million. Yeah. Would be
thank,
a lot.
Thank you for that clarification.
Sure. I thought, wow, that's quite an ask.
Yeah.
It won't ask for any more.
Okay. Who's next? Good morning.
Good morning, co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner and members of the committee. I'm Jack Barth. I'm a professor of oceanography at Oregon State University, and I'm also now the executive director of the Marine Studies Initiative at Oregon State University. But I'm happy to be here today as chair of the Ocean-Going Research Vessel Council that actually makes decisions about the use of the funds that you've granted to us for this excellent program. Oregon is an ocean state. Our economy is based on it. It modulates our weather. We just heard about the Climate Change Research Institute and the state climatology. The ocean's absolutely critical to all those things and what we do in our daily lives. And what this program allows us to do is get a vessel out to sea to keep our fingers on the pulse of the ocean. We absolutely have to know what's going on out there. So this program continues to fund the research vessel Oceanus, which you see in the bottom diagram there. We've run it for several years now, looking at programs that go out to sea and look at things like ocean acidification and hypoxia. We tracked the warm blob as it came out of the North Pacific to our shores, and that influenced the harmful algal blooms, which in turn influence the domoic acid and the delay in the Dungeness crab harvest. So all these things are connected, and we have to be out there to pay attention to those. So the program allows us to get to sea. It actually leverages $4.5 to $5 million per year for operation of the research vessel Oceanus. That allows OSU to keep operating that vessel and to study Oregon waters. The multiplier on that is probably another 4 or 5 in just research grants that come along with operation of the vessel. So we've been happy to double our participation by students going out, and I've brought 2 students with me. I'll introduce them in just a minute. We've got good spread across the institutions in Oregon. U of O ran a very successful cruise in November where they took 17 undergraduates out and 6 graduates for a cruise offshore. We were pleased with a joint project, which is a marine mammal survey along with a STEM education experience for 4 high school teachers from our coastal communities. And we were fortunate to be able to bring the RV Oceanus up to Portland and continue that outreach by bringing students from STEM programs in the Portland schools onto the research vessels to make that connection of why the ocean is so important. We had a Portland Community College undergraduate is about to sail with us. She's a minority female majoring in geology. So here's an excellent opportunity to get out to the coast and further her education. So these are the projects funded over the last year, and our students actually went out on some of these. And as I mentioned, some of them haven't sailed yet. They're about 2 weeks away. The one second to the bottom, the environmental history of the Columbia River, that's looking at the offshore area taking cores of sediment and studying the large changes over time, geological time, of course, in the Columbia River. So you'll hear more from the students beside me, but this is just a quote that these are really life-changing experiences, getting the students out in the field. And I want to point out that this state investment allows OSU to compete at the very highest levels in the nation. This is the new regional class research vessel. This is the state-of-the-art vessel that OSU designed, and we'll be building 3 copies of it. We just got approval by the federal funding source. This is a $376 million program, and OSU is leading that, and it's because we're able to show the state support for our ocean-going research vessel program.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Sir, the students, do they get credit for the cruise or the writing papers or anything?
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith, Warner, Monroe, and Representative Wisner, that's absolutely right. And it's not just sending them out, but building it into a class such that they prepare the plans at sea, they collect the data, and then they can get credit for that internship or part of it.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair, real quick. Do you know if the other state programs give students their programs are offered? I know that some are non-credit, but the other state programs offer students credit? They are part of their program, do you know?
I can, Representative Witness, I can speak to the U of O program run by Craig Young out of OIMB, U of O's Marine Station. He, again, structured it as part of a undergraduate course. And so both the TAs, which are graduate students, and the undergraduates are getting credit.
Thank you, sir.
So I'd like to, better than me speaking more about this, I'd like to introduce our two students today. We have Izzy Corby to my right, and then Aaron Guillory. And they'd just like to say a few words.
Welcome.
Good morning, co-chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner and the rest of the committee. My name's Izzy Corby, and I graduated last fall with an honors bachelor's of science in marine biology. And just to speak a little more on the credit part, being able to partake in these cruises was really phenomenal for me because as an honors student, I had to complete a thesis, and when I began, I was handed a set of samples from a cruise that my advisor had gone on already that I wasn't able to partake in because it was before I started with him, and went through all of the in-lab analyses and data processing of those. And so being able to go on a cruise later and seeing how those samples were collected and exactly the process that we go through to get all of that data just helped me a lot in that process to be able to really understand what I was looking at and write about it a little more coherently. Additionally, being able to go out on the ocean as an undergraduate, I think, is really important because it's just such a unique and kind of like physically taxing experience. And so being able to see whether or not, you know, for example, you get over being seasick. We've had some students in our lab who don't, and that's a little more unfortunate. Luckily, I do, so I had a more positive experience than they did. Being able to find that out as an undergrad, I think, is really important because it definitely helped me decide what I want to do as I pursue grad school and pursue more work in research and things like that. So,
thank you.
Aaron? Hey. Hi. My name is Erin Guillory. I am an undergraduate student at OSU. I am a non-traditional student. I'm from Louisiana, but I came out here to follow my dream and study the oceans. I did find it daunting to invest in an education and perhaps a career where you don't know what the field work is like. But fortunately, I was able to go out to sea, and it solidified for me that this is exactly what I want to do. It's definitely an inspirational experience, and it can really change everything for an undergraduate.
Questions for these ladies? Senator Roblin.
More comment and whatever. I appreciate both of you getting the opportunity to get out in the ocean, because it is a deal. I hopefully will get out in the ocean soon on a Merlet study on the same boat. Weather has to work out for you when you're trying to do things. And I hope that people understand the design of this new generation of research vessels. The federal government picked OSU to do the design work. So they did that. There was no necessary understanding that at the end of that process, when they build the boats, that we would get one. But there is now. So there is a commitment that one of the three new boats will be coming to Corvallis, which is a really big thing for us. And I do believe that it is all about the fact that we as a state invested in general fund money to help keep that boat going for a number of reasons. We have a lot of stuff out in the ocean, including marine reserves and others that need research done, and we need to have our fish and wildlife people and our other people having the opportunity to get this research vessel when we need it for different kinds of things, if we're really going to make decisions based on the science out there. And I have appreciated this for a long time. I appreciate the students. I was an oceanography major at the University of Washington a long time ago. Never got to go out to sea. Changed my major. But, you know, you get to go to the lab areas, like up in Washington, it's out in the San Juans. Here it's at Oregon State. Or if you're in Oregon, you're down in Coos Bay, Newport or Coos Bay. But it's really important to have opportunities if you're really going to try to pursue those kinds of things that give you the experience that both of them just mentioned. How do you deal with the sea? How do you deal with being seasick? Because most people at one time or another are going to get seasick if you're out there. So I appreciate you coming and testifying. I appreciate the fact that you're doing the work you're doing. And I didn't realize that there was as big a program with respect to undergraduates using the boat as there is. And I think that's another really big positive with regard to really understanding if this is something for you or not. So thank you. And thanks both for participating, coming all the way from Louisiana.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You don't have a real ocean over there. You got this little pond up there.
Yeah, exactly.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Co-Chair, thank you for this presentation, and I think that's great that we have the students able to do this. I've been down to visit from the shore many times, the vessel. It's had some funding issues, several sessions, because it is expensive. But, Mr. Co-Chair, I've heard a lot of this presentation in higher education. I really have some questions, but it's not so much about the statewide programs or this specific program, but who oversees the state programs? Who do we have key performance measures? How much money? How is the money for these organizations affecting students' tuition and the overall university funding? I ask the question. They're integrated. Well, integrated, does that mean does the universities eat all their expenses for everything? And does that come out of the money that we're looking at to charge tuition? I'm sorry, but I'm not. Getting budget data from the great presentations, great organizations, especially this one. I don't know how many FTEs we're looking at. I don't know what their budgets. I know a bottom line, but that if someone's integrated, it's costing university money to integrate them. How much is that?
Dr. Barth, you want to try that? Or?
Actually, with the permission of the co-chairs, I'd like to invite Jan Lewis back from the overall point of view.
Okay.
Thank you for your presentations.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ms. Lewis, can you tell us how it's all budgeted?
Again, for the record, I'm Jan Lewis with Oregon State University. And I just briefly wanted to do a little bit of follow-up on the question about the origin for the Labor Education Research Center. In the Senate Bill 5509 from 1977.
Budget bill.
Yes. It is a budget bill. And the budget report had a few sentences on it. It stated the Labor Education Center proposed by the governor was approved by the subcommittee. While the center is to be headquartered at the University of Oregon, it was approved with the express understanding that it will practice an outreach extension philosophy and take its programs off campus to its clientele whenever practicable. So that is the historic information that we had as far as its origin.
Yes, ma'am. I have that too.
Yeah. And regarding the integration of the
program. And that would have been Governor Straub, by the way.
Yes, sir. I have all that data. I can also tell you why he said he was establishing, but I won't do that on record. Thank you.
Okay. I was actually there in 1977.
And there was some additional information provided, I think, recently on some of these programs that tried to show the dedicated stream that comes through the state programs, any supplemental university funding they receive, if they receive gift funding, or if we leverage into federal or state grants. And so I think it's very challenging whenever you talk about any activity at a university, because wherever there's interest in expanding into one or other of our missions, it may start out primarily instructional, but then if there's opportunity for research, folks go that direction, or if there's an opportunity for public service. I would hope that one of the takeaways you have from the presentations is that there's sort of a natural effectiveness if the state has a particular public service activity. When you go to the universities where there's expertise or program infrastructure, that a lot of times it's a very natural place to have the universities host these activities on behalf of the state, and it totally fits with one of our major missions, which is public service. And when you look at these individually, like in the case of the Marine Research Vessel, I mean, that's one that readily morphs into opportunities for students, while some of the others may have just more of a focus on the public service aspect. But just by the very nature of those facilities and programs being housed at universities, students are everywhere, and they're exposed to these as well. So it's an onion that's very difficult to peel into distinct buckets once they get established.
Follow up, Mr. Kutcher. Thank you, Mrs. Lewis, for your comments. our job, I think, and my job is to be sure that we provide quality education to our youth at a four-year university at the lowest cost possible and in the quickest time possible. We have had meetings and meetings and meetings and testimony about how the tuition continued to rise. I know that we don't give you all your money. We give you a small part of that, and I understand that. But we're supposed to be looking at how the taxpayers' money is being spent. And I don't know how I can look at a budget and say, prove it, and I don't know what the total cost of that function is and what that function's doing, what its outcomes are. You just establish some goals, but what are we meeting those goals? Are we, I don't understand. If you combine total here, is a lot of money. And when you start looking at providing office, travel, you never answered, do they go to conferences? Do we pay for that too? Does that come out of their nonprofit that they gain or what? There's a lot of, I have searched for 13 years and I don't have a lot of data on how these programs are manned, funded, operate, and how it affects the bottom line. Your overall mission is to educate students at the lowest cost possible in the quickest time possible. And thank God we're now working on a formula that says your ruling mission is to graduate them. And the state funding will be based upon that. I just, co-chairs, I don't think I've gotten information where I really understand why we're doing this and how it affects the students' bottom line. Thank you.
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. So I'm trying to understand what the implication of what you're, or the implication of your questioning is, because it's not being very direct. Or I can't ask questions. Oh, sorry, freshman. then I'll redirect and make it more of a comment. As somebody who worked at the university system while as a student there in student government, I did learn, and I sat on the university senate, I did learn that universities usually make decisions based on demand from students and also based on not necessarily what politics is dictating, but more so what does exist in our society and how do we fulfill and meet those needs regardless of what field they're in, whether it's forestry or business or agriculture or labor. My fear is that if we start to allow politics to dictate what programs exist, then we may see targeted programs like those that don't believe in climate change may try to target climate research facilities. It's just very dangerous slope, in my opinion.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just wanted to kind of, I believe that Representative Wisnett, I have been constantly impressed by his dogged determination to, indeed, he is very focused on our kids of every age, and I agree with him with his goal of trying to maximize, to make sure that everything we do is to maximize that education responsibility that we have to our kids. And I would just throw out that I believe that the public service parts in particular, I believe there is a value to the state in the kind of services they provide, from the population information to LURC and the marine work, the work that we do to support the agriculture industry, to support the marine biology, and it's kind of all of that across the spectrum. That I would argue that there is value both in education, whether it's getting the kids into those programs and exposing them that way, and that university system, which is indeed a public university system, doing work to support the state as a whole, the industries, the workers, the businesses, all of that. And I would argue that I think we can weigh that as part of a benefit, specifically as part of a benefit, in a cost benefit analysis of what we are of what we spend our resources on.
Senator Roblin, and then we're going to need to move on to the second part of our.
I just want to follow up what was just said by our co-chair. Universities research is really about making us an economically viable state. And if you look at these in particular, they all came out about because of needs we as a state had, not necessarily that students had. And figuring out how do we get an impartial third party of researchers to help us answer the question. So population, we now use that. If any city wants to go out and figure out how to change their urban growth boundaries, they're going to go to the center to find out the information, which used to be they had to spend a lot of extra money trying to find. We fought on this one a little bit a couple years ago on the fermentation science because it wasn't going through the process we've always gone through. It came right to the legislature, and we put it in because we had a big growing fermentation group, and they were willing to put a whole lot of money into Oregon State, including stills and other kinds of things, so they would have equipment and be able to do that because they wanted to get the best science possible for us to figure out how to deal with fermentation science across the Broadway from bread to beer to wine, and now fermented milk, which is always interesting. So, I mean, it's been around for a long time. People buy it in the stores, the Russian brand, the kefir. So it is getting our companies and other people in the position to be successful because the research behind it is there. So I agree with trying to balance the issue with respect to tuition and kids, but there's also a bigger purpose for university systems in every state. And I watched North Carolina just beat up everybody for a while because of the triangle that they had there in North Carolina that brought all that research together and really formed this place for business to say, yes, we're coming to North Carolina. So in those reasons, I think we have to look at these carefully, make sure this money is spent right. But thank you. And I agree.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I just want to echo slightly what Representative Wisnett said, and I want to put it in a different context. I don't mind that universities research things. I think that's an important part of what they do. My concern is the evaluation process of, if the LURC, for example, has been around 40 years, at what point have we not researched something to death? And do we just keep putting money into those same or in any of these? I love the Food Innovation Center. That's one of my favorite things.
I agree.
Having been down there and toured that, I think they do a great job, with those kinds of things and the forest products thing research. But what is our overall process as a body to actually take every one of these in its own and really look at that and say, is there some research we're not funding because we've always done this project over here or whichever one it is? I'm agnostic of what they are, but what is our mechanism to actually look at that evaluation process and say, do we want to keep making this investment? And I know we get kind of these presentations, and then we say, okay, we'll fund them or not fund them or vote on them how we want to vote on them, but that actually isn't necessarily a process for comparing them side by side and looking at the overall value that they represent and then making a funding decision based on, are we still going to keep going down this path? And I think that in a subsequent session, we might want to figure out a process for how we look at all of the research that's happening, prioritize it, bring in people in the industry to kind of defend it or, the value that it's providing, and hear that level of conversation. And to me, this is my seventh year looking at these types of budgets, not on this committee, but to make a voting decision, and that's information that I think is missing, has been missing for me.
Thank you, and thank you, Ms. Lewis.
Yep.
May I make one
further
comment?
Yeah, one final comment.
Okay.
And then we've got
so I do want to just go back to the splitting of the funding of education in general, and the other side of the equation, the Public University Support Fund. It now, through the PEC, has been focused on outcomes, so there is much more emphasis on that. And then I'll double-check to make sure that you did get this supplemental information that showed the various funding sources because I have to turn my head. I'm reading this sideways because for FY16, when we had about $18 million in funding for these state programs, it was also leveraging about $9.2 million in gift funding and about $22.6 million in federal grant and contract funding. So all of these things do work together to advance these different programs. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Okay, let's have the ballot measure 99 folks. Nancy Bales and Paul and Scott Reed and Bruce Rhodes. I guess you can all come on up. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, there's not a presentation document for the PowerPoint on this. They will, I asked them when I talked to Mr. Reed last week to delineate a bunch of funding questions as well as supply of providers or whatever you want to say, and what the infrastructure is like for providing this program over time as well as the immediate future. So with that, given the time, we should move right on.
Okay, who's first?
Co-Chair Smith-Warren, Co-Chair Monroe, good morning. I'm Nancy Bales with the Gray Family Foundation, and I'm here along with my co-presenters to provide background and answer any questions you have on the outdoor school statewide program. The goal really with establishing this statewide program was to make sure that we could ensure that all fifth and sixth grade students, regardless of their income, their ethnicity, and their geography, have equal access to this hands-on place-based education program. This is a shared experience for Oregonians. It dates back more than 50 years, and it's really shown to build confidence, get students excited again about learning, and teach critical skills outdoors. Oregon State University was chosen to be the home for this program because across the state, Oregonians voice their confidence in OSU Extension Service. Extension's deep roots in their communities, the excellence they've shown in providing programs such as the Oregon Natural Resource Education Program, their 4-H program, and the Oregon Environmental Literacy Program, just to name a few, make it an ideal organization to support the statewide outdoor school program. And so while I'm here to speak about the value of outdoor school and the funding to support it, I also want to express support for the core extension budget. The governor's recommended budget with the $3.2 million shortfall will result in the elimination of 70% of the gains that were made in 2015. And regarding the budget for outdoor school specifically, Gray Family Foundation's experience with this program, we took a close look at what I felt were the levels of readiness across the state at this point for this first biennium and the different levels of programs. And we recognize that it's going to take a couple years for this program to fully scale. But I believe, based on my experience, that for the first biennium, $30 million would fully fund this program. And that also leads to questions around facility and capacity across the state to host these students. And we also, through our grant programs, support camps across the state, and we have a program that has been providing maintenance and repair funds to camps that host outdoor school for many years. And we know from our conversations and our relationships with camps that there is additional capacity at this point still, and they're very eager to have this new opportunity. This outdoor school is normally run when camps are not fully booked during weeks in the school year, and it provides them that gap. It enables them to keep staff on for a longer period of time, and they're very interested in extending their seasons at many of these camps. So we've been talking about the possibility of having additional funding for them to winterize and provide different longer seasons for camps. And in addition, we've been thinking about over the long term, what does this look like? And as different as outdoor school is across the state, so are the models for delivering it. And there's opportunities with state parks and city parks even to do outdoor school. There's groups now that are doing it with tents and yurts and pop-up kitchens. So there's lots of models in different parts of the state. And we've already started some of those discussions with OSU Extension and State Parks and others. The goal is to have this program reflect what the community looks like across Oregon. Philanthropy needs to continue to play an important role in this program as it has in the past. And once we're not doing direct funding to implement the program, there's a lot of ways that we can do that, and that is with the camps. But it's also with training for teachers and more opportunities for post and for pre and post learning for those students to in outdoor school. There's also opportunities for increasing ADA accessibility at camps around the state. There's many that have that, but there's many that would like to have more options for that. And developing and supporting programs for high school students and younger students as part of this. What the funding from the state does is it really helps to ensure equality and access for all students, where philanthropy can really only fill the gaps. And I'm going to turn it over to this at this point to Paul Barnum.
Co-Chair Monroe and Smith Warner, members of the committee. My name is Paul Barnum, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. And we are a commodities commission that was created by the Oregon Legislature in 1991 to advance public understanding of Oregon's forests, forest management, and forest products. We are funded by a portion of the forest products harvest tax, paid by both industrial and non-industrial forest land owners. And we are governed by a 13-member board, the voting members appointed by the state forester. So it's only been in about the past 5 years that OFRI has become more engaged with Oregon's outdoor school movement. And frankly, I think that our involvement was overdue. Staff and board members alike now believe that outdoor schools represent a tremendous opportunity for young Oregonians to gain a fuller appreciation of the state's history, culture, and economy as a natural resources-based state. With increasing urbanization, we have fewer and fewer school children today have that connection with natural resources in the outdoors. I think that's a problem. Richard Louv, in his book Last Child in the Woods, aptly describes this problem as nature deficit disorder. Especially in Oregon, with our rich renewable agricultural, forestry, grazing, and fishing resources, we need citizens who understand the linkages between sustainable natural resources management as the means to meeting our most basic needs, food, clothing, and shelter. OFRI's K-12 staff, as well as myself, we've visited outdoor schools. We've met with outdoor school leaders at both the Multnomah and Northwest ESDs to understand their needs and how we in the natural resources sectors can work together with them to provide outdoor school experiences that are relevant, meaningful, and fun. We're excited to be working with the folks at OSU Extension to extend outdoor school programs across the state, giving every fifth or sixth grade student the opportunity for a resident-based outdoor experience that's appropriate for their area. We believe that the advisory committee that's been formed is inclusive of Oregon's diverse interests, values, attitudes, and beliefs. And we, kind of representing the forest sector, look forward, along with our natural resource partners, to providing students an outdoor school experience that honors the role of farming, forestry, ranching, fishing, ocean-based economy that we just heard about, and that also impresses upon students the importance of environmental stewardship to maintain and protect all that we love about this great state. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today.
Thank you. Who's next?
We have Bruce Rhodes from Tillamook School District.
Good morning, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, and members of the committee. I'm here to give you a perspective from a school district standpoint. So I'm a district office administrator in Tillamook.
Your name on the record, please.
What's that?
Your name.
Okay, Bruce Rhodes.
Thank you.
Yeah, from Tillamook School District. Sorry. And we've had outdoor school in Tillamook for over 45 years. We've been one of those districts that has maintained that. Many districts have not. And so right now there are a number of districts that have continued outdoor school, those that have not. And so this bill, these funds will actually give an opportunity for all the different students and all the different districts to participate in outdoor school. The two main seasons of outdoor school are, of course, during the better weather, so the fall season and the spring seasons are when school districts book their outdoor school settings. And so the first point I would make would be that getting the funds available as soon as possible. So we've always done this in the fall. We have things organized and booked for next fall. And having those funds available as soon as possible, very important for those of us that have that on our schedule and have that lined up for next fall. It's also going to be important for those districts that don't have currently outdoor school scheduled. The earlier they get the funds, the earlier they have a chance to plan and have access to those funds, the earlier they'll have a chance to move forward and get those things scheduled and organized that way. From a curriculum standpoint, from the opportunity for students to go out and have hands-on experiences with natural resource professionals in many cases. Most outdoor schools recruit many volunteers from their local settings, so from state parks and from federal agencies and state agencies. Those are the people that contribute to outdoor school. So students have a chance to interact with professionals in the field. And it's always in this, I'll use the word integrated curricular setting, so there's writing involved, there's many times extensive reading, there's literature. The teachers take time before outdoor school to work those kinds of elements into it. There's a lot of math components, and for many students to get outside and to get their hands dirty and to apply the things they learn in the classroom to hands-on real-world examples, it's a valuable experience. I mentioned the opportunity for students to interact with the professionals in terms of getting students ready for college and careers. This fifth, sixth grade time is a really critical time for students to start making those career kind of identify within careers, and a chance for students to interact with professionals at that fifth, sixth grade level is a great step forward for them to start thinking about what they're going to do career-wise. The last point I'll make is outdoor school is an incredible place for building relationships. And for those of us in schools, the opportunity to build relationships with students and to make that impact on students, you've probably heard about trauma-informed practice. It's a lot of what we're working on in schools right now is how best to build relationships with students to make some lifelong impacts in their life. And during outdoor school, it's an incredible opportunity for students and staff to experience something kind of outside the regular classroom setting and to build those relationships that matter in a long ways. And the last element I'll mention is many outdoor schools utilize high school students as counselors. And that's an incredible, it's one of those win-wins. It's an awesome benefit, valuable benefit for the fifth or sixth grade students. And it's a huge, huge opportunity for those high school students to step into somebody else's life and make a difference there. And the memories and the relationships that are built between the staff and the high school students and the grade school students literally last a lifetime. So thank you for this time, and thank you for your support of this.
Thank you. And when you get a chance, you might want to talk to Senator Johnson about how important this program is.
Okay, I can do that.
Mr. Reed.
Good morning, co-chairs Monroe, Smith, Horner, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Scott Reed. I serve at Oregon State University as Vice Provost for Outreach and Engagement and Director of the OSU Extension Service. First, I'd like to acknowledge the great honor that comes with the opportunity to help guide this classically Oregon program known as Outdoor School for All. OSU Extension has, as many of you know, for more than 100 years, provided solution-based community education that includes the acclaimed 4-H Youth Development Program. We're also the home of the Oregon Environmental Literacy Program. Since late 2016, we've anticipated that outdoor school may become a funded reality, so we put into place some early work that will allow us to start up this program as efficiently as possible. With financial support from private donors, my office has established interim leadership for outdoor school. We assembled an internal coordinating committee and brought together a broad interest group a couple of times for their early advice and guidance as we anticipated starting up. At this point, I've established the formal advisory committee called for in statute that met in early May. Both Nancy and Bruce are members of the advisory committee. We've begun a search process to hire a permanent director of outdoor school. And with the help of the OSU Business Center, we've developed a business model and documentation that's ready to issue that will establish the relationship and provide compensation to districts who elect to move forward with outdoor school. You should know that the enthusiasm for this program is through the roof. More than 100 people applied and went through a review and evaluation process to be selected for the advisory committee and the associated working groups that will help develop detail and provide input to the advisory committee. These two bodies will work together to identify resources that will support both experienced and new schools to begin to implement outdoor school and to deliver the best practices, programs possible inside of outdoor schools. The working groups, as they're configured now, are addressing outdoor school sites, curriculum, on-site activities, professional development, research evaluation and assessment. And finally, there's a working group that we're calling Thinking Forward that anticipates changes over time and looking for ways to add innovation to this program. Dates are set for the second advisory committee that'll be joined by the working groups in July that'll focus on year one implementation that'll be based upon the funding that's available. Under any circumstances, the academic year 2017 and 18, year one of the biennium, will be a startup year, and it will be intended to both support schools with established plans and ensure, to the extent that funding is possible, that we reach those who are least likely to have the opportunity without such funds. The advisory committee at their first meeting left us with 28 recommendations around six areas, with initial priority for what they called a straightforward approach to year one, while building durable practices and tools over time. In year one, we'll first adopt a simplified application that the Gray Family Foundation currently uses. Secondly, we'll establish relationships with districts and ESDs via an intergovernmental agreement for a period of time, inside of which will be proposals that my office will consider, work orders, and then invoices to ultimately compensate for the outdoor schools themselves. We'll also provide equitable funding support on a per capita basis, at least for the first year, that will be the basis for participating students. Here we borrow a concept from the way K-12 is already funded with the so-called ADM model, where schools are funded on a per student basis. Naturally, some questions remain about outdoor school that will be addressed over time, especially as we build experience and learn as we go. A couple of examples are, what is an equivalent experience that's allowed for in policy? Second, and something of really importance to us, is this notion of access for all. How do we accommodate special needs youth? And here we believe it's possible to vary the per capita payment, to scale it based upon the additional expenses associated with a special needs student. Access for all is a particularly important question for us. Here the examples might be home and private schools that aren't automatically connected to a district that's identified in the ballot measure. And one approach that we're considering here is to organize and offer an open enrollment outdoor school so that regardless of the origin of the fifth or sixth grader, they may, engage in an outdoor school that's designed for the variety of use. Let me just close by acknowledging that what has been dubbed Outdoor School for All really will be a learning experience for all, not only in students, but for the institutions, and you see us here before you today, that are engaged in developing curriculum, implementing, evaluating, and improving this historic program. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Roblin?
So a couple things. First, I just wanted to say, if people don't understand how much effort the Gray Foundation has put into this over the years, they should, and I want to commend them. The new Gray camp that's in Newport that OMSI has put in is, if you haven't seen it, it's a pretty amazing facility, and a number of other people put into it. I was very concerned about this implementation when it passed. I do appreciate the fact that it had money with it, which some other things are having we're going to have a harder time implementing, I believe, in a good way. But in this particular case, again, the philanthropic organization, you heard it up here, came through and said, if we're really going to have this happen, because I started talking to people saying, how are we going to implement this? Do we have enough camps? Do we have enough people that actually could teach it? I had lots of questions and couldn't figure out how we were going to get it. So when I saw the first iteration from the government at $24 million, I thought, okay, I mean, it's going to take a while to build this up. And then I found out that the philanthropic community had already engaged. They had started taking and their resources and putting it into organization with the people at the universities, to making sure the camps were out there and that they were ready and able, and finding out how many places there were. And it became clear to me that this was not something we were trying to do alone just because we had a ballot measure, but in fact there were a lot of people behind it. And it became clear to me that we are more than ready to get going at a much faster pace than I had originally anticipated. And so I'm surprised to hear 30 million. I thought it might have to be more, because I had talked to some people about 31, because I think many and most schools will try to get there as quickly as they can. And I would rather not have a situation where schools are waiting and there's a waiting list to get to these places where we have places available and so on. So I hope that we look at it very carefully, recognize it is coming out of our limited resources that happen to do with the lottery. But at the same point, as people have pointed out to me repeatedly, it overwhelmingly passed by the people. So I'm trying to deal with that one with another one that had no money with it. The work that has been going on by everybody here has been pretty impressive. And if you want to see some of the results that this can provide, I would tell you to go and look at Tillamook High School's graduation rates with respect to non-traditional students, as well as all others, because they've outperformed most of the state with respect to that. And in talking to some of the staff and others, they believe it is that relationship and that understanding of our local community through outdoor school that really set the table for getting them through high school. So I just wanted to make sure that I appreciated all the people who I've seen work on this kind of thing. And I guess the other thing is, clearly, do the people up here think 30 million will be enough to do the kinds of things in this biennium, knowing we have to get started? Because I'd really like to make it sure it's the right number.
Madam Co-Chair? Okay.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warren, Senator Roblin, thank you for the question. I do think that 30 million is going to be enough for us to execute in the first year for OSU Extension to
start.
Right, first 2 years. Sorry.
I can go with the first year. I mean, if that's what it was, that's the ask.
We recognize that there will be some scaling, and it is unfortunately the challenge is that we don't have a good sense of at this point where.
Which
and
school?
Actually, one of the other things that I've invested in through the Gray Family Foundation is having someone who is actually calling every school, surveying schools and students to find out what exactly their desire is for next year. Have they been going in the past? How many students? And information like that. But from the analysis, I think the important thing is that there is flexibility with the funding over that 2 years, and that OSU Extension is able to get funding out the door in this first year. For the schools for the fall and spring session.
If I could just add, Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner, Senator Roblin, we've considered, if funding available, to partition some of the first-year funds and issue them as planning grants to schools that haven't done an outdoor school before, but they're anticipating getting ready for one, so that we can provide them the kind of, you know, technical and advisory support so that they're ready to go not later than year two of the biennium.
Good. Thank you.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just briefly, thank you all for being here. I guess I just wanted to say I hope that as we implement this, I think that, again, yes, it was overwhelmingly voted on by the voters. And at the same time, I think my assumption would have been, well, there is outdoor school. It's widely done across the state, even though not universally. So I guess I would just say I hope that as we go forward, there are many curricula that already exist. It's a fairly – I hope we don't do too much recreating of the wheel in the most respectful way possible, that there are lots of great curricula out there already, that it's more of a share and move rather than establish – a whole new structure around implementing it. That's all.
I've been involved with and a supporter of the outdoor school program for more than 40 years. My father was a college professor for 35 years and was a renowned naturalist. And when he retired as a professor, I, as a young state representative, I was about Diego's age, got him a job as the naturalist at Camp Colton in the outdoor school program, and he served there the remaining years of his life.
and enjoyed that more than he ever had being a philosophy or history professor. And he just always expressed great joy for his work in that program. It's exciting. It's exciting for the teenagers that get to be junior counselors. It's certainly exciting for the fifth and sixth graders. My grandson just went through it. And it's wonderful that we're going to have that opportunity for all of Oregon's children. Anything else, Doug?
Wednesday, there will be presentations by the various education, Chief Education Office, ODE, on concepts that are found as proposed by the governor in Senate Bill 182 on educator advancement and 183, which is dropout prevention, attendance. Yeah. Those are two major initiatives by the governor. We won't have the bills in front of us and won't take any amendments or anything, but we thought we'd better get the concepts on the table before we move quickly through the end of session.
Good idea.
Any questions? Does that relate to 183 anyway? Kind of relates to ballot measure 98, doesn't it? Or at least there's some crossover there.
Mr. Chair, there is some crossover in subject area for sure.
Yeah, okay. So we'll look forward to Wednesday. And if that finance committee ever gets their work done, we might even have more than 2 days a week. Thank you all very much. We appreciate it. This meeting's adjourned.
I heard they're planning on getting done before July 4th.
Adjourned.
I heard they're planning on